Sometimes when things clear away, you're not watching it, you're in your car, and you start going, oh, no, here it comes that I'm alone. Like, it starts to visit on you. You know, just the sadness.
Yes.
Life is tremendously sad just by, you know, being in it. And so you're driving, and then you go, that's why we text and drive. I look around, pretty much 100% of people driving are texting.
Yes.
And they're killing, everybody's murdering each other with their cars.
Yes.
But people are willing to risk taking a life and ruining their own because they don't want to be alone for a second because it's so hard. I was in my car one time, and a Bruce Springsteen song comes on, and it made me really sad. It's like Jungle, what the one's the Jungle song?
Jungle Land.
Jungle, this one where he goes, hurry! And he sounds far away. You know, I was like,
that's half of them.
Yeah, that's a lot of them.
No, he goes, hey,
and it's really far away sounding. Yeah. And I heard it, and it gave me kind of like a fall back to school depression feeling. It made me really sad.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, I'm getting sad. I've got to get the phone and write hi to like 50 people. And then, you know, somebody cool writes back, and then somebody not as cool writes after, and I'm like, oh, f*** you, I'm not going to... I got somebody better. But,
hey, how come you didn't answer my text?
Speaking of which,
because he wrote first. That's right. So, anyway, I started to get that sad feeling, and I was reaching for the phone. And then I said, "You know what? Don't. Just be sad. Just let the sadness just stand in the way of it, and let it hit you like a truck." And I let it come, and Bruce, and I just started to feel, oh my God! And I pulled over, and I just cried like a bitch. I cried so much. And it was beautiful. It was like this beautiful, it's just this, sadness is poetic. You're lucky to live sad moments. And then I had happy feelings because when you let yourself feel sad,
yes,
your body has like antibodies. It has happiness that comes.
Rushing in
to meet the sadness. So I was grateful to feel sad. And then I met it with true, profound happiness. It was such a trip, you know, and the thing is, because we don't want that first bit of sad,
yeah,
we push it away with like a little phone for the food, and you get a little kind of... You never feel completely sad or completely happy.
Right.
You just feel kind of satisfied with your product.
Yes.
And then you die. So that's why I don't want to get a phone for my kids. That's what I'm going to do.
That man sitting on a little stool takes some money from my hand while his eyes take a walk all over you. Hands me two tickets, smiles and whispers good luck. Well, cuddle up, angel, cuddle up, my little dove. Well, ride down, baby, into this tunnel of love. Well, so scared of, gotta ride down, baby, into this tunnel of love.
To trust one's mind and to know that one is worthy of happiness is the essence of self-esteem. The power of this conviction about oneself lies in the fact that it is more than a judgment or a feeling. It is a motivator. It inspires behavior. In turn, it is directly affected by how we act. Causation flows in both directions. There is a continuous feedback loop between our actions in the world and our self-esteem. If I trust my mind and judgment, I am more likely to operate as a thinking being. Bringing appropriate awareness to my activities, my life works better. This reinforces trust in my mind. If I distrust my mind, I am more likely to be mentally passive. When my actions lead to disappointing or painful results, I feel justified in distrusting my mind. With high self-esteem, I am more likely to persist in the face of difficulties. With low self-esteem, I am more likely to give up or go through the motions of trying without really giving my best. If I persevere, the likelihood is that I will succeed more often than I fail. If I don't, the likelihood is that I will fail more often than I succeed. Either way, my view of myself will be reinforced. If I respect myself and require that others deal with me respectfully, I send out signals and behave in ways that increase the likelihood that others will respond appropriately. When they do, I am reinforced and confirmed in my initial belief. If I lack self-respect and accept discourtesy, abuse, or exploitation from others as natural, I unconsciously transmit this, and some people will treat me at my self-estimate. When this happens, and I submit to it, my self-respect deteriorates still more. The value of self-esteem lies not merely in the fact that it allows us to feel better, but that it allows us to live better, to respond to challenges and opportunities more resourcefully and more appropriately.
Hi, everybody. I am very pleased to welcome back to School Sucks Podcast, Wes Bertrand from Complete Liberty. How you doing, Wes?
Great, Brett. Nice to see you again. Actually, we have video this time, so it's not just hearing our voices. It's cool.
Yeah. And you're in Texas.
Yep. Deep in the heart of Texas. Indeed. Down in San Antonio, actually, which I believe has the highest per capita police force in the nation. So, you know, everything's really secure down here.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I remember from, you know, the Ghetto Boys videos when I grew up. It looked like a really safe place, you know.
Very, very safe. Almost too safe, dare we say. Texas has a lot of military stuff going on. So that kind of goes in line with that. This idea that government's supposed to provide these basic, you know, protection services for us. But we don't really get served and protected, do we?
No. You know, I've noticed that there isn't too much of that.
No.
And I'm not trying to force a segue here, but it reminded me of something that Nathaniel Brandon wrote in his book, The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem.
Mm-hmm.
With so much discord and uncertainty in the external world, we should probably try to create as much certainty, stability, and free ourselves from discord. We should try to do that as much as we can in our internal worlds. And that was his observation, gosh, I guess at this point, almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's kind of a timeless insight, isn't it?
It certainly is. And at least in a political context, as time goes forward, perhaps there is more turmoil and there is, in a more challenging world, a greater need for us to have that inner peace and stability. And that's what we're getting ready to do here. This is going to be, at the very least, a six-part series on Nathaniel Brandon's Six Pillars of Self-Esteem.
Here's what the book looks like, by the way. There's the cover. You can get a hardcover and softcover, I believe, too. So it was published way back in 94, I think.
I also, if people are interested in checking it out for themselves, I just purchased an audiobook version from iTunes that I believe was about $11. And it's not that long. It's 3 hours, maybe, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the term self-esteem is certainly used a lot, but it's rather vague. And I think that one of the observations of fellow podcaster Jake DeSillis, I heard him talking about this book in a psychology book club they do.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that during the self-esteem movement that was 30 years ago, 40 years ago, self-esteem in many ways became synonymous with self-acceptance and was not so explicitly about self-improvement.
Hmm.
So for a lot of people, self-esteem just meant accepting things as they are. And that also has kind of a new age movement aspect to it.
That you're a worthy being.
Well, there's that, but also the accepting things as they are. And, you know, the best you can do is just sort of channel your positive energy at what you'd like to see change in the world.
You mean like the law of attraction stuff?
Well, these ideas that it sort of strips, the ideas lead to people being stripped of their personal power, I think. Mm. Or their own self-efficacy.
I see.
So self-esteem is more than just passive acceptance and self-acceptance. And, you know, the title of the book, or rather the way the pillars are described, it's not just the obtaining of new knowledge that you need to live consciously. It's the practice of living consciously, the practice of self-acceptance. In other words, these are actions that you have to integrate into your being and your doing. And I think that's very important. I know that I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but there's something that I really want to integrate into my life, and I go out and I do the research and I invest a fair amount of time, and then I say, "Well, okay, the only step left is implementation, and that can be done. That can be done at any point.
Execution,
you know, yeah, and that's the trick.
It is, yeah. The implementation. You know, there's that phrase in business that you know, good ideas are a dime a dozen, but the implementation of good ideas, that's the trick, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
So if you were introducing this concept based on your study of Brandon's work, what do you tell them self-esteem is, and what are people aiming at if they strive to raise self-esteem?
Yeah, because it is very all over the map in terms of a definition in the culture, isn't it? As Daryl, you know, you guys did that series on voluntary communication. He has that term definitional wobble, is it?
Yeah,
lots of definitional wobble in the realm of self-esteem. And it's even been criticized, like Brandon's definition has been criticized by at least the likes of Albert Ellis, who was the founder of Rational Emotive Behavioral Therapy, I believe. Yeah, Albert Ellis. So they got in a debate one time about that because he was more aligned with what you were talking about in terms of acceptance, just basic acceptance of ourselves as worthy beings, not trying to judge ourselves or evaluate ourselves, but just that basic core acceptance, which actually is one component of Brandon's definition. However, he adds some other aspects that I think are equally important because, you know, we were looking at that page on CNVC.org, the Center for Nonviolent Communication, and they have a needs inventory there. And you don't see self-esteem there as a need, but it nonetheless is. You just need to cobble together a bunch of those needs that they have listed for under, like, basically meaning. There's integrity, there's efficacy, there's, you know, self-worth, there's acceptance. There's a whole bunch of different needs that could be kind of just compiled together to equal self-esteem. But just in short, for Brandon's short definition would be a sum of self-confidence and self-respect. So to consider your mind worthy of happiness, your person worthy of happiness, and your own mind's ability to really understand reality in a non-contradictory way, to make sense of things. And he also adds, like, to cope with life's vicissitudes, to be able to meet the challenges of our existence with the sense that we are capable, you know, having that conviction of efficacy, self-efficacy.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the sum there. So if you look at it as a combination of self-confidence and self-respect, that's probably the simplest way to sum it up. But of course, in the culture, there is this notion that self-esteem is what other people tell you your worth, in a sense. Like they heap praise on you, and that's supposed to increase your self-esteem. Or you're supposed to think well of yourself, even if you're not thinking well of yourself. You know, how do you process your feelings? And there's this notion that we need to feel good about ourselves regardless of what we're actually feeling, which isn't going to be very helpful in terms of self-acceptance, is it? Or living consciously.
No, absolutely not. And it's kind of putting us at odds with reality, right? Because we're just trying to force out, you know, part of self-esteem, as Brandon describes in the book, is being open to the facts of reality. So when you picture a scene of somebody doing this positive, sort of panicked positive self-talk where they say, I'm going to my cave, I'm going to my quiet place, and they're trying to basically bat away the inputs from reality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more to it than that. There's more practices than happiness through surrender and acceptance.
And complacency, perhaps, like to surrender to the status quo even. You know, you talked about this immune system of consciousness. That's how Brandon phrases it, in terms of how do we deal with all these different systems that we're interfacing with in our lives. The more detrimental those systems are, the more we really need to focus on self-esteem, don't we, to be able to cope with these things. Otherwise, you know, we're going to become victimized in many ways and traumatized in many ways. So how do we keep focused on our own sense of understanding of things and our own well-being amidst a society that doesn't really value those things? I mean, we have, you know, the police is the quintessential power over institution. I remember Bill Buppert, who has a site called ZeroGov, .org or .com, I can't remember, but maybe it's .net. But his son actually convinced him of anarchism. Pretty interesting. He was a former military guy, and therefore thinking that, you know, we need these basic protection services the government provides. However, the big contradiction there is, you know, if you're going to protect people, don't steal money from them to protect them. And that's what taxation does. So to be able to use your mind to reconcile these contradictions that are readily apparent in our society, instead of just seeing cops as this, you know, really something to avoid, obviously, because no one really has a pleasant encounter with cops, but to really understand that this is a power over system that's essentially anti-self-esteem. It doesn't trust human beings to do what is helpful for them. You know, it basically considers everyone a suspect and a potential criminal, you know? So that's why in libertarian world, there's that notion that don't say anything to the police because they will use it against you, regardless how nice they seem to be. So the institution itself is a power over institution that doesn't embrace the fact that we need to think well of ourselves. We need to have a conviction that we're able to think clearly and provide well for ourselves to meet our own needs, essentially. So that's where self-esteem can be this immune system of consciousness to help stave off all these essentially pathogens or antigens that is really impinging on our own happiness.
Yeah, Brandon also describes it as you know, trying to do away with the idea or this perception of self-esteem as just a feeling or a judgment.
Yes.
It is a motivating force that allows us, you know, not to basically, you know, tuck ourselves in and try to run through the difficulties of life, but to actually stand up straight and face them, which is, you know, a motivating force more than just the feeling that, yeah, I'm okay, you know?
Yeah, it takes more than that, unfortunately, you know, in our culture. I would say, you know, from a developmental standpoint, look at it from childhood's point of view, like a child in need of self-esteem. I think that children inherently flourish in a context that honors their self-esteem. So they don't necessarily need to consciously focus on it so much as have it honored in their midst. But like I was saying, we have all these systems that don't honor self-esteem. They do the exact opposite. So now we really need to put the focus on it so that we don't lose sight of our own value and get swept up in a bunch of domination thinking, essentially, about ourselves and about others. So I think just by virtue of being reasoning beings, being aware that we are fallible, that we make mistakes, I mean, I don't think any other animal out there is aware that they're making mistakes, right? And they don't put themselves down for making mistakes. They don't think bad things about themselves because they did something that they regret, you know? You could say that maybe dogs show some guilt after eating the steak that was on the counter.
Yeah.
But they've learned from encounters previously, I think, with humans, that is not acceptable, right? So how does an animal that doesn't have a reasoning ability deal with their own sense of value? I think it just becomes basically an automatic process for them. But for us, we have that choice to devalue ourselves, you know, to think not so good of ourselves as a result of either other people's disapproval, which typically happens in parenting processes, or just from our own choices. You know, there's a section in here on the immune system of consciousness chapter talking about the impact of self-esteem and general observations. So when they do research on self-esteem, they have what's called an operational definition, and they try to look to the different behaviors and thoughts that are correlated with that particular construct, with self-esteem being the one here. So he notes there are positive correlations between healthy self-esteem and a variety of other traits that bear directly on our capacity for achievement and for happiness. Healthy self-esteem correlates with rationality, realism, intuitiveness, creativity, independence, flexibility, ability to manage change, willingness to admit and correct mistakes, benevolence, and cooperativeness. So in contrast, poor self-esteem correlates with irrationality, blindness to reality, rigidity, fear of the new and unfamiliar, inappropriate conformity or inappropriate rebelliousness.
Mm.
You know, so that's kind of the package deal that we're given in this authoritarian system, right? That we either conform or we rebel, but we can never really be an autonomous, independent person with value in our own right, you know?
Yeah.
So we see a lot of rebelliousness that leads to self-destructive behavior, obviously.
Yeah, and that's definitely one of the things that I've noticed is that not all rebellion against authority is noble, obviously. And especially when it continually fits a self-destructive pattern. Yeah, you're right. It is that false choice that we're often given. It's like, especially in school, it's like, well, conform to your detriment or rebel to your detriment because you have no power. You're going to pay a price either way. And it's a very, very difficult situation to be in, but also as far as what it imprints on us, it's a difficult thing to have happened to us to be able to work our way out of and beyond in life.
Yeah, there are all these systems of distrust in our midst. And self-esteem is having trust in our own mind, in our mind's capability, in our mind's value, our own person's value, you know, having trust in ourselves. And when we're in the midst of a bunch of systems, parental systems, schooling systems, religious systems, and of course, nation states that distrust individuals, distrust your own mind's ability to grasp reality as it is, rather than surrender and sacrifice to, you know, Rand's term, hawk shops of authority, you know, redeem your mind from the hawk shops of authority. That was one of the phrases that John Galt uses in Atlas Shrugged.
Right.
That's a very powerful way of stating it. To redeem our minds from these things is also to generate self-esteem, essentially. But the other couple of things that are correlated with poor self-esteem are defensiveness, over-compliant, or over-controlling behavior, and fear of or hostility towards others. So,
as you're going through all these attributes, it just of both high and low self-esteem, it speaks to what complex systems we actually are. And Brandon in the book talks about, you know, it's not abnormal for a person's self-esteem to fluctuate in life.
True.
You know?
Yeah, we can exhibit the spectrum of these things, obviously, in different parts of our lives even. We can compartmentalize things, right?
So before we started recording, we were talking about diet. We were talking about what we eat, right? And it is this continuous experimentation a lot of the time to like, am I having too much of this? Do I not have enough of this? And, you know, trying to get the balance of in this system right. So one of the things that's useful about the six pillars of self-esteem is that even though there's all of these elements to it, he does a good job of lasering in on actual practices, you know, that are really, really helpful guides to doing what pillars do, raising something up. So or holding something up.
Yeah, because without the implementation, we're just lost in our heads, I guess.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And we're not able to actually create the values that we want in the world. And that number one value is the belief in ourselves, right? If we don't have a belief in ourselves, it's hard to believe in anybody else. It's hard to believe in our own capacity to generate happiness and to achieve things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we've talked about what self-esteem is. We've talked about why it is important. Some other questions that Brandon tackles in the book is, you know, what can be done to raise it? And that's really through his explication of the six pillars. And he does also acknowledge that other people can play a role in our self-esteem. So that's something that we'll get into as well. As far as the format for our shows here, because each one of these things is a practice, we wanted to devote an episode to each. We wanted to put a week between each episode. So if people feel that this is something that they want to work on, you know, they'll have the time to try to more consciously approach each one of the pillars. And obviously they do. There is sort of a building block effect here as well. But that's how, you know, we're introducing the topic now. We're going to talk today about the practice of living consciously. But I hope people will, you know, embrace this topic, this book, too, if they think it would be helpful. And, you know, go week by week with us and, you know, try to implement or integrate what they hear here.
Yeah, for each chapter, he provides this pretty amazing technology or methodology called sentence completion exercises. Mm-hmm. And so you provide a grammatically correct ending to a sentence stem. And this is designed to access your subconscious thoughts and feelings about things without any sort of conscious censorship or, you know, overanalyzing things, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a really efficient and effective way to get to that stuff that's underlying our everyday consciousness, that's triggering emotions and having us do things that we notice that aren't so helpful for ourselves, you know? So we become more acquainted with that world, that subconscious world, which is something that we can avoid. People do that all their lives sometimes, you know. This is probably a time in human history where there's been the most introspection, I would say. I mean, you go into the self-help section of any bookstore. Barnes Noble, I think, is the only one left now, right? Even just little bookstores. But yeah, there's lots of self-help books out there, lots of different things that are trying to assist in living well and understanding ourselves, making sense of things. And what I like about Brandon's perspective is that, you know, he comes from the world of objectivism, of teaching this philosophy for living on Earth, as Ayn Rand talked about. Now, there's various misapplications of it in terms of like having a monopolistic government, which is problematic on many levels. But the basic structure of objectivist principles, you know, the metaphysics of we live in objective reality and the laws of identity and causality and non-contradiction, to really understand that, you know, is really important because that's our place in the cosmos, essentially. We're on a planet, in a solar system, in a galaxy, and we're reasoning beings. We use concepts to make sense of things. So how do we sort through all of the different concepts that we have in our world, you know, especially the philosophical ones, because that's a whole world that is really filled with contradictions in this day and age. You know, objectivism is not the predominant philosophy. And in epistemology, you know, reason as our means of understanding our sensory perceptual input, essentially integrating things into concepts so that we have definitions to really understand each concept in a non-contradictory way. And then logic, using logic as that method to do that, you know, that's really important. And then she was, you know, Rand's philosophy of objectivism is really the first one that explicitly says, you know, you don't need to sacrifice yourself to others or have others sacrifice to you. So it's the first non-sacrificial ethics. And this is where it kind of bridges across to nonviolent communication, because Moshe Rosenberg, the founder of that, doesn't advocate sacrifice either, which is an amazing insight for human beings, because we live in a world of collectives, of the tribal premise that we need to sacrifice to the group in order to get along. Otherwise, you know, all hell's going to break loose, supposedly.
Yeah, we've mentioned the state a few times in this conversation, and you know, one of the things that I've posited before, and I feel like there's some evidence for this from my own research, is that statism, or the state itself, very much seems to be a symptom, of what human beings haven't figured out yet, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, when in terms of self-esteem, the definition that we're using here, trying to put myself in the shoes or the I guess throughout most of history they didn't have shoes, and I'm trying to think of an old-timey synonym for footwear, but to try and see the world through the eyes of people who've been living for thousands of years. And in terms of self-esteem, like thinking about self-efficacy, even 150 years ago, the natural world, the scientific world, was so bewildering and confusing. And obviously the spiritual world that was kind of being foisted on people at childhood is creating so much, you know, uncertainty. And I would think such a sense of smallness that when it comes to self-respect or self-actualization, I wonder if people who lived long ago even understood the concept of being an individual, being separate, having unique desires and needs. But self-esteem, like free time, is something that we've kind of earned through evolution. You know, it seems like not self-esteem itself. People should always feel like they're efficacious and respect themselves. That would have been nice if that was true all throughout history.
Yeah.
But I think from most of time, it wasn't even a concept that people could get their head around. Like going back to colonial times and telling a farmer about, oh man, you know, sometimes I'm just so bored. I just have so much free time. You know, I don't, it's like I need a hobby. He'd punch you.
I need to take some time out to do some self-improvement work.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll get to that hay later.
Yeah, what are you talking about? So yeah. These are sort of the rewards of evolution and not just, you know, physically, but industrially and, gosh, yeah. Dare I even say, maybe in some respects, politically, we've stepped out of, in some ways, in some places, harsher forms of government. They always seem to eventually slide back.
Yeah, yeah. At least a recognition of the individual, you know, this idea that individuals do have rights. They have inherent freedoms that ought not be violated. However, when you set up the game with an organization by definition that violates them, then you're in big trouble. So, yeah, I think self-esteem is definitely a concept whose time has come, shall we say.
Yeah.
But no doubt people throughout history have thought about themselves and tried to make sense of really what it means to be an individual. But oftentimes, like you say, the tribal premise was so predominant that people weren't recognized for their individualism, their autonomy, and their choice. So, I mean, there's cases to be made that primitive humans had more recognition of autonomy and choice. And basically, if you didn't like what the group was doing, you're free to leave.
Yeah.
You can opt out, right? Whereas in nation states, you can't necessarily opt out because where do you go? Just another nation state, right? You're roped in. You got to get the passport, the other passport, the other sets of visas, and all that jazz. So, yeah, I would say that the state is a manifestation of poor self-esteem in society. It's a manifestation of these feelings of mistrust about self and really not a confidence in our ability to meet our needs without conflict, without having to bash other people over the head, without having to threaten them for sustenance. I mean, if you just look at taxation as threatening people in order to live, essentially. We don't need to do this in this day and age. Everyone that's working in government can provide for themselves and others in abundance in a free economy.
Yeah.
It's just that they were taught otherwise, and they're kind of in an entrenched system that doesn't recognize those basic truths.
Yeah, yeah. So all that being said, I think we've got a nice way to move into living consciously.
Yeah. Maybe one preface to that would be to talk about it as a need, you know? And Brandon actually has a section in here about self-esteem as analogous to the need for calcium or any other, you know, micronutrient or something essential for us, but you're not going to die without it. You're just going to be impaired and malnourished in some way.
Yeah.
So I think that's important to distinguish that from those physical needs like food and water, which if you don't have, you're going to die. What is it? You can live without food for a few weeks, I think, before your organs start to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
You can't live more than a few days without water.
Right.
That's it's game over. That's an essential thing we need. So needs can go the spectrum of imminent death by not meeting them or gradual. And he says, you know, we should note that sometimes lack of self-esteem does eventuate in death in fairly direct ways. For example, by a drug overdose, defiantly reckless driving of an automobile, sometimes when drunk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remaining with a murderously abusive spouse, participating in gang wars, or suicide. However, for most of us, the consequences of poor self-esteem are subtler, less direct, more circuitous. We may need a good deal of reflection and self-examination to appreciate how our deepest view of ourselves shows up in the 10,000 choices that add up to our destiny. So, that's an interesting way of putting it.
The 10,000 choices. I'm thinking, like, just based on, you know, the number of choices you have. You have, I would say, hundreds of thousands of ways that any day could go, you know?
True. Yeah, have you ever tried to count how many choices, even those little micro choices of, like, grabbing this spoon instead of that fork? You know, those little things that we do on a daily basis, hundreds of little things. It's amazing.
I mean, oh my goodness, the difference between having your bed in the middle of a room or having your bed against the wall doubles your amount of choices in a day right there. You can choose which side to get out of it on. you know?
Exactly. Or which end to sleep on, right? I don't think there's many people that would like have the bed up against the wall and then their head is out on the other end. but it happens.
Oh my goodness, the choices, we're not even out of bed yet. We've got choices. So
I know. It reminds me of that Passion of Ayn Rand. That was a biography that Barbara Brandon wrote about Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
And I think it was in there. It might have been in Brandon's memoir too, but they mentioned that Ayn Rand's sister came to visit from Russia, from the Soviet Russia. And she was just overwhelmed by the amount of choices when they went to the grocery store about, you know, umpteen different brands of toothpaste and everything is like multiplicity of choices. And she was just so overwhelmed. She wanted to go immediately back to Russia where there's really no choices. You get one choice. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, economically. So obviously self-esteem plays a role in there too. Like, how do we manage all these choices in a way that we're comfortable with, that we don't second guess ourselves, that we have this flow state where we're okay with making this choice as opposed to that one. And it could have gone the other way too, you know?
Yes, absolutely. And one more unrelated question before we move on to living consciously, I'd just be interested in hearing your thoughts. You've seen, obviously, Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yes.
How do you feel about it? Often the word self-esteem is put on there. The phrase self-esteem is put on there.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about where it is?
Yeah, isn't it like towards the middle?
I think it's closer to the top. I'm trying to pull up an image. I mean, usually the top is self-actualization.
Yes.
And before that, you have self-esteem. So obviously we have the most basic sort of physiological needs at the bottom, followed by safety, followed by love and belonging, followed by self-esteem, working up to the top, and the top is self-actualization. I always found this interesting.
Yeah, so I'm not a big fan of the hierarchy thing, and okay. Nonviolent communication is not either. You know, he has sexual intimacy, friendship, family as a more a fundamental need, I guess. Like he says that you need these prior needs, the bottom needs need to be met before you can reach the next level, right?
Yeah.
Although I think that he would probably have some reasonable interpretation as well, like saying that a person could reach some of these esteem needs before, say, some friendship or sexual intimacy needs or those kinds of things. But I just don't like the way it's set up as a hierarchy, as a pyramid, you know?
No, I mean, it seems like it would be more concurrent to me as far as I just know when some of the elements of self-esteem are not in place, you can, or I should say I can, from my own experience, be kind of dangerous to other people. You know, like you can't always fulfill the needs that other people have and meet the responsibilities of certain relationships if certain mm-hmm. things on, you know, my side of the street are not swept, so
yeah,
to speak.
And you can be really dangerous to yourself as well.
Yeah.
Like Brennan mentions, driving recklessly or even suicide, the ultimate expression of having impoverished self-esteem, right? Of finding, well, and you could see that as a strategy to try to deal with something that is incredibly miserable and despairing about your life and having no hope, essentially. But as libertarians, we believe that everyone has the right to use and dispose of their own body as they see fit. It's
yeah.
just that if you really value yourself, you're going to find ways that are not self-destructive, right? So if you suffer from low self-esteem in some aspects, you might end up overeating or undereating. You know, all kinds of things related to health and nutrition can be related to self-esteem as well. I mean, all these things are interrelated, obviously. Like that's why CNBC.org has that needs inventory and they don't prioritize anything really. It's just that, like we were saying with Brandon about needs, some of them are pretty lethal if you don't meet them quickly. Other ones just impair your ability to flourish if you don't meet them
right.
over time.
Okay, so yeah. that makes perfect sense. And that answers the very questions that I was having when, I mean, you do a Google image search for self-esteem, and obviously this hierarchy of needs comes up again and again and again. And
yes.
I was obviously, you know, I learned about this, I think, like in, when I was tutoring people to take the early childhood certification exams.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back on it with new eyes, I was like, this, you know, I don't want to say it's out of order, but yeah, there shouldn't be this order to it. So I was just interested in your input on that. And
maybe from like the anthropological standpoint, you could see, like we were talking about before, this is a time that people are more focused on introspective things, the more about the inner world these days, which, you know, lends itself to understanding self-esteem in new, insightful ways, and self-actualizing as well. Like for most of human history, people were trying to feed themselves, trying to survive. Basic survival needs were being put as priorities, obviously.
Yeah.
But they were also caught up in systems that prevented them from actually moving to those other places in self, if you will, that allows for more self-actualization and understanding of self. So, yeah, it's kind of it's an intertwined process, I would say.
That was probably what triggered it in my mind, was our conversation about the general struggle of life further back in time, where you would be, it would be very decadent of you to ever get beyond like the first or second phase of the hierarchy.
And to really understand self in a way that is not what the norm says, essentially, because that's usually what people do. They live in these cultures throughout the world, and they just take what other people are doing and the rituals and traditions as the given, and that's the norms, and we just abide by that to get along and to enjoy ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
So focusing on self-esteem is like our first step to really questioning these systems that we've been in, the norms, questioning the norms that we're used to, the mores, if you will. So it's an act of self-assertiveness, which is one of the pillars that he mentions.
So I wanted to talk to a little bit about the process that we're going to use for each pillar, just so people have a preview of what we're going to do. We're going to identify what the pillar is. That takes a matter of seconds. Define what it is. Then discuss some of the obstacles in really the realization. And we might share, if applicable, some personal stories or struggles with each one of these areas, and hopefully through that conversation, we'll be able to discuss some strategies for overcoming those obstacles.
Yeah.
So are you ready for the first pillar?
Sure. Yeah, all right. The practice of living consciously, huh?
Yes. I think often we think of consciousness as just the seeing and knowing in a very, very basic sense what's around us. And what Brandon really incorporates, and I think this is what leads to obviously being able to embrace the rest of this book, is it's not just seeing and knowing, it is acting on what one sees and knows or experiences and knows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so having this reasoning capacity grants us the ability to really understand reality and understand our place in reality in a way that other organisms can't. It's interesting, he has this quote, I've always found it amusing, "We are the one species that can formulate a vision of what values are worth pursuing and then pursue the opposite." Yeah, so there's that.
Now, well, we have obviously a very powerful emotional tug of war going on a lot of the time. So, you know, it's interesting when you read the quote, it sounds like it's to our detriment. And it obviously is, but it's because of this this equipment or this ability that we have that nothing else does. And, you know, we need to learn how to...
All those choices.
Yeah, but we need to learn how to manage that, which is something, unfortunately, that we don't get a lot of practice with in safe environments. It's not really made explicit for us in formative years. So it can become very tricky to manage that emotional equipment.
Yeah, yeah. When we've been told a bunch of things that don't really honor our self-esteem, that we're not good enough, that we're not worthy, that we can't think straight, you know, that you make stupid mistakes, stupid idiot. You know, all these kinds of just anti-self-esteem messages that we get. And whether or not we agree with them consciously, they sometimes get integrated subconsciously. so they can really undermine our own efforts to do kind things for ourselves and kind things for others.
Yeah, and run in the background.
Yeah, yeah, like these kind of malware apps, if you will. So I think living consciously is probably, obviously, the first step to really opening up this world of self-understanding.
I think there's a lot of power and control that can be had from, you know, that continuous effort to understand or answer the question, what's going on in myself? You know, I feel like there was at least a couple scenes in the Iron Man movie where you have this guy inside the suit, right? But it's not, it's like malfunctioning, and it's just kind of taking his actual being, like, oh, you know, I can't control this thing. And, and you know, life feels that way sometimes, where we are, at least from my own experience, and, you know, looking back at a situation, especially the further I go back in time, and sometimes I just, I cringe. I say, wow, why did that happen? Why did I do that? What was I thinking? You know, that kind of a thing. And I guess the reason why I use something as powerful as the Iron Man suit is it's like we feel out of control in ourselves, you know?
Mm.
And often when it's happening, we don't even realize it. So
yeah.
I think that integrating this thinking not only obviously aids with the other five pillars, but it's so important for everything we do in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And so to relate that to the definition of living consciously, I guess it's to be mentally active rather than passive. Like, that's the struggle of living consciously. When we notice things that we don't like about ourselves or others, and how do we broach those things with ourselves? How do we make requests and develop new strategies that are going to serve our lives more? And I'm using terminology from nonviolent communication for a reason here, because I think it is really instructive and helpful for us to not put ourselves down for things that we don't like or things that we regret doing, but rather to look at the needs we were trying to meet when we were doing those things, you know, and to honor that, to look at any given time in our lives as, you know, the twin sum of self-confidence and self-respect, to honor ourselves in this process of living, so that we don't, you know, become at war with ourselves, as Brandon says. We don't live in an antagonistic relationship with ourselves. And that will be our explanation and exploration of the next one, which is the practice of self-acceptance. But to really honor ourselves, no matter what we're doing, and to understand that we're still trying to meet needs in some way, enables us to be more open and be more conscious of our mistakes rather than walling things off, you know, and pretending like we're okay in terms of how we're making choices, that there's no other choices to be made besides this. You know, you constantly hear the refrain from police or people in the government system that they're just doing their jobs, or it's the law, you got to follow it. There's no choice. There's no choice. There's no living consciously. There's no exploration of the reasons why this law is there in the first place and what its rationale is, you know? And then start understanding the psychology behind that. Like, that whole process is the practice of living consciously. To really look at, you know, peel the onion of those systems that people take for granted because of the lack of consciousness that people are bringing to them, you know?
Yeah. I think it's worth repeating that living consciously, it doesn't mean we have to like what we see, right? But we have to see it. And maybe that's, you know, that's the more important thing. That's the harder thing to do, but the more necessary part. And it's not just, well, yeah, I don't like what I see, and I have to see it. We can develop this self-acceptance, which is next, obviously, by really looking at that stuff and recognizing what needs were behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that goes back to what we were saying earlier in the show, where the self-esteem movement or the sort of new agey self-esteem movement became see what's there and like it. And obviously that, again, puts you in a somewhat adversarial relationship with reality, because there's going to be this subconscious thing going on that's like, no, you don't like this. Stop telling yourself you like it. You know, there's going to be at least a conflict. So this is one part of many.
Yeah. And we all know that we live in a world that favors unconsciousness about so many things. Like, don't rock the boat. Don't upset that apple cart, right?
Yeah.
Don't ruffle people's feathers or rattle people's cages, you know, that kind of thing. The cages that we live in, you know, don't want to be rattled in some sense because it upsets the systems. The systems are in equilibrium, right? They're in a process of homeostasis, I guess. So how to live consciously amidst all these things that are going against living consciously, that itself is a challenge, and that can lead to living less consciously because it's easier in some sense, you know?
Yeah.
I think that explains a lot of the state of the world today. But if we were to go down the list of the attributes, obviously, you know, living consciously means attending to reality, some aspect of reality. So noticing things, this is our basic process of reason, right? Identifying and integrating stuff from our senses and our perceptions.
Yeah.
Right. So living consciously, as he notes here, the specifics, a mind that is active rather than passive, an intelligence that takes joy in its own function. You know, just think of a child's sense of life in that regard, asking why all the time.
Absolutely.
And you could insert the Louis C.K. skit on that one.
The why, the child who asks why, and eventually he just
keeps asking why.
Look, you know, this is great. I'm sorry I'm so stupid as your parent, and I don't have any idea. No, you're really right. And you can really see young children. I've obviously observed it with kids who have not entered any kind of institutionalized schooling yet. Really just marvel, maybe not in what they recognize as the ability or the capacity of their mind, but just their mind's ability to kind of interact with the world around them. It's exciting, you know?
Yes, it totally is. And they are the future of humanity if we don't get in the way of that consciousness that they're bringing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
So being in the moment without losing the wider context, that's another sort of tension that we have too. Like Zen Buddhism, for instance, you know, advocates the present moment awareness and integration of mind-body functioning and so forth. But it's also important to keep conscious of that wider context. So why are we doing the things we're doing? Why is this culture the way it is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are people pursuing these values instead of those values? Why are they using these strategies instead of those strategies? The question why really is the essence of living consciously, isn't it? In some sense.
Yeah, this was such an important one for me. It was this need that I had to be more present, especially with people that I cared about, and to be more available in what is actually happening right now, whether it's an activity that I care about or some interaction with another person, that really led to my embrace of things like the getting things done method, right? Stress-free productivity. But also a word that's used over and over in the book again is presence. This also speaks to an author that you informed me about some time ago, Daniel Siegel. And taking time in. And he uses that phrase, present moment awareness. He has a meditative practice that lasts about a half an hour where he puts you kind of not in your own mind, but just in your own body in a way for a lot of people that might be uncomfortable. Like you're kind of taking a tour, especially if you're somewhat health anxious or a hypochondriac. You're basically taking a tour in your mind of all the systems in your body, and it's a very confronting exercise. But really, what I felt was so important about this one is because of disorganization, or because of biting off more than I could chew off a plate that had too much stuff in it, I was not available as much as I could have been for the things that I was doing or the people that I was with, you know? So that was like, I guess 5 or 6 months ago, something that I really identified in my life that I needed to start working on. But you see, obviously, all the rewards for living consciously. The only time in our lives that we can actually affect or actually, you know, experience in a way where we can have an effect is right now.
And all we're living in is the present, essentially. Any given moment is the present.
Yeah.
But we can think about in the present, about the future, present moments.
Yeah.
You know?
But the thing was that channeling attention into the future in the form of worry or anxiety, because it's a place where we have no power, or channeling attention into the past in the form of remorse or regret or longing for a time that's gone, also a time where we have no power, is stealing that power that we could have in the moment, you know? Whatever the vagueness that the presence is, it's what's happening right now. It's the place we are now, the place we need to be. And it doesn't mean those other times aren't important, but we shouldn't be channeling energy and attention there at the expense of the present moment.
Because that can take away from our own sense of understanding and other people's sense of visibility, too.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So reaching out toward relevant facts rather than withdrawing from them, that's another one that we see with children that we don't so much see with adults, unless it's, you know, particular tasks in the workplace or something. But these basic philosophical principles that shake out in terms of the facts of the culture oftentimes are avoided, you know, withdrawn from those things because it's kind of scary to really look at things as they are, you know.
When I first read that one, many adult faces popped into my mind, you know, people I've had disagreements with before. More in a political context, I heard the phrase probably said to me more than once, that's not what I choose to believe, or I don't like to look at things that way.
So in other words, noticing and confronting my impulses to avoid or deny painful or threatening realities wasn't really considered, I guess.
Well, Not in what they said, right? But I think there's that there's a subtle confrontation going on, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not choosing to see it that way. That way makes me super uncomfortable.
And I'd rather have more ease and comfort now with a different view of things than could be seen if I raised my awareness, perhaps.
Right, right. So, you know, I used to think that this was just a struggle for most people in the political, economic, talking about education, talking about perceptions of history, things that were more academic, you know? And I realized that it obviously translates to family matters, it translates to parenting. And my recognition, you and I actually did a series 3 years ago, and called it Escape from Imagination Land, where I was saying, you know, I've had this problem so much in my own life, in my personal life. Where's the empathy for other people, you know, in these contexts where I feel like I'm such a master, you know? This is hard and it's confronting. And, you know, we get caught up in all these often emotional and often quite vitriolic subjects. And it's important for me anyway, to when I feel myself, when I feel my face getting red, to say, no. I know what that feels like. You know, I know what it's like to not want to confront something that's going to lead to me saying, okay, time to change something.
Sure, because it's perceived as a burden or some sort of maybe a demand that you're placing on yourself to change. And that goes back to childhood, you know, when we're told to do something or else. And so we decided to go off on our own and rebel at various times. And it makes it more difficult to really regroup and see that whole process as a learning experience that can be very enriching.
Yeah.
Obviously, to change to new strategies that are going to be more effective and more helpful and lead to more joy. It's just that most people don't see that joy. They don't see the light at the end of that tunnel that requires some effort to get there.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. So like this one, being concerned to know where I am relative to my various personal and professional goals and projects and whether I am succeeding or failing at those.
Yeah.
So the context, rather than just kind of floating through life, you know, just going with however the circumstances present themselves, rather than really living consciously and saying, okay, I can chart my own course here. I can pursue values that I really cherish and achieve things.
That also really lines up, obviously, with the stress-free productivity conversation that we were having a minute ago when it came to another attribute of living consciously, being in the moment. Obviously, this is the creation of power and control in ourselves, right? Because when all these things are kind of swirling around us in life that we have to do, and they can be very, very small, but if it's out there and not captured and not being integrated, it's a bee, you know? It's not just some small thing that's zipping around. It's a potential danger and at least a huge annoyance or distraction. So, yeah, being able to make sense of all that stuff is really, really important.
Yeah, so that dovetails into being concerned to know if my actions are in alignment with my purposes. So living consciously about that, not being off the rails.
Oh, that's a...
Finding out what the rails are, you know, what rails do I want to have to go to a certain place in terms of my goals. And enjoying that journey, too, because a lot of people set themselves up for this idea that happiness is going to be right when I reach that goal.
Yeah.
Right? It's not now. You know, I can't be really happy now because I haven't achieved this, that, and the other, you know?
Yeah, and that's something that it seems like people do that for pretty much all of life, and or there's at least a heavy pattern of people who do that, I'll be happy when. It seems to start when we're very, very young, right? That happiness is something, or the inculcation of the idea that happiness is something that's deferred. Of course your life sucks right now. You're in school 40 hours a week. You're nine.
Yeah.
You can't drive. You know, you don't even know how to cook. Yeah.
And there are some things in life that you got to do that you don't want to do.
Seriously. Yeah, but if you stay on this track of shittiness, one day it ends at college,
death,
right? And then
college.
Oh no, there's it's not a direct route, right? There's a couple of stops along the way, and then you can be happy because you'll be free, and then you get to college and you say, yeah, oh well, this isn't ideal either, but one day there'll be a career.
Mm-hmm. Get that job ticket.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then maybe the career comes.
Then you realize that the career entails doing things that you don't really want to do, and there's a lot of bureaucracy and corporate bullshit maybe, and IRS forms to fill out, and then pretty soon you're right back to square one with this quest for happiness, right?
Yeah, so you walk around the office with your coffee saying, oh, Steve, is it Friday yet? Hey, Maggie, exactly. Is it Friday yet? Oh, my goodness. So again, happiness deferred now on a 7-day schedule. But most of the people that I know, Even if they say they like their jobs, and maybe they do like their jobs, they talk about retirement.
Yes.
That's
retirement.
When I'll be happy, you know?
Mm-hmm. No more work to do. No more, you know, adhering to someone else's schedule. I can be my own person, do my own thing. Unfortunately, at a time when I'm less vigorous, you know?
Yeah.
That's one of the laments, I guess, about this aging process. Like, if we could start out with retirement as teenagers and then gradually work our way into the, you know, the working world as we get older and older.
Yeah.
But just doesn't work that way. So yeah, retirement, people can give up on their dreams, on their hopes, their passions, which isn't to say that hobbies aren't something that can be really embraced and enriching for your life. You know, I think as long as people keep their minds active, regardless of what they're doing, whether it's for a paycheck or not, I think it's just more ways to find, you know, well-being and enrichment.
And I think there's a lot of people who do find happiness here and there. But in my observation, people I've been close to and a life that I've led in the past too, is that it's more like it often feels like you're kind of zipping and bobbing and weaving in this congested traffic jam of all these things that are trying to make you unhappy. And you're occasionally like finding your way to someplace you actually want to be. And that was no way for me to live, right? That happiness was something that you could find, but you really had to go out and like dodge other people trying to ruin stuff for you and other happenings trying to sabotage happiness.
Yeah, so how to empower ourselves to achieve it internally rather than have it depend on external circumstances, because those are pretty fleeting for the most part. So that internal, you know, Daniel Siegel talks about mind sight.
Yes.
Having that mind sight to really be aware, bring consciousness to our inner world so that we can heal and grow in that way towards happiness and actually realize that happiness is that that process of really attending to our inner world and having empathy and compassion for this process that we oftentimes find pretty challenging. I mean, I was thinking about self-empowerment and how children, their first attempts at empowering themselves are sometimes shut down. They're not allowed to do certain things that they are really excited about doing. And after repeated shutdowns, you know, you kind of lose a sense of vitality for actually being empowered.
Yeah.
You know, to chart your own course, you know?
Yeah.
So this one about searching for feedback from the environment so as to adjust or correct my course when necessary, you know, you kind of can give up on that because when you've sought feedback before, it was pretty harsh and negative and disappointing, you know? So what's the point, right?
Mm-hmm. Today, you know, it's interesting though, just on the feedback.
Yeah.
That's the one that I feel like, I don't want to say oversensitive, but really, most of these other ones I can really identify with some part of it or some past failing in that specific area. But, oh yeah. Man, have I always just been like a glutton for environmental feedback, you know? So it's just an interesting observation. Someone told me it was because I was a Leo, you know? That's my astrological sign.
Okay.
And I'm a seeker of attention. I think that's probably not the explanation that I'm going to go with.
And so is this feedback solicited or unsolicited?
It doesn't surprise me, you know?
Gotcha.
I'm excited, especially with what I do now, to see how it affects other people. But mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, the more I think about it, obviously I've done a lot of things in the past that I probably didn't want to see. I probably wanted to cover my eyes when it came to look at how it affected another person.
So the tendency to avoid living consciously in those realms. Yeah.
Yeah. So that definitely, that cuts both ways. Sure.
Uh-huh. So to really realize, and it gets back to the compassionate communication too with ourselves, to realize that, you know, we can be our own harshest critic, you know?
Yeah.
And to realize that we're just pursuing a particular strategy or set of strategies to achieve some needs fulfillment, you know? So not to wrap our identity around the strategies that we're using. And I think that's what happens when we take criticism personally, in a sense, right? It's pretty easy to take criticism personally because we've supposedly thought out our course of action and someone else determines that it's incorrect. It's not helpful for them at all. You know, they don't like it and they use all kinds of language to describe it that it's really hard for us to hear, you know, the compassion in there, if there is any, you know?
Yeah.
So it's easier to live less consciously in those realms sometimes. But just to sort of disconnect our identity from our strategies and to realize that we are in the process of learning all the time and formulating new strategies is part of that process. So it's helpful to get impressions by others about what's going on within us and what we're doing. Do they like or don't like what we're doing, you know? And it may trigger them too, because the more consciously we live, the more stuff may be triggered for them about that process, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's another thing to consider. As we raise our consciousness, it kind of ups the ante for everybody else. And to help them compassionately connect with their capacity to live consciously is another challenge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, these attributes can lead nicely right into the next one, because sometimes environmental feedback is one of those difficulties that we encounter next there.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
persevering in an attempt to understand in spite of difficulties.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, sometimes in environmental feedback could be, you know, shaming based on conventions that people have accepted maybe without enough thought. That the law, you know?
Yeah.
That certainly fits in there.
So if we look at the law, the people that make law, lawmakers, contribute to the voluminous law libraries. Is there much being receptive to new knowledge and willing to reexamine old assumptions going on? Not really.
No.
Yeah. No. Yeah. It's unfortunate. I mean, it's so tragic, actually, because that's kind of the key ingredient there. If people were receptive to new knowledge and willing to re-examine old assumptions, we would probably live in a different world practically overnight, because these old assumptions really need some examination and some overturning and transformation, some changes, some alterations. Yeah, so that dovetails into being willing to see and correct mistakes, you know, being comfortable with our fallibility, that we do make mistakes. It's a natural thing to do because of the choices that we make. I mean, other animals make mistakes too, like a leopard that jumps from out of the tree down to the ground, maybe one paw hits a rock. It wasn't intending to do that. It kind of hurt the paw, but it was just something that happened. And it doesn't spend its time regretting that it did that, you know, or berating himself because that happened, you know. It just lives. It just processes that information and learns from that mistake, you know. The brain naturally learns in that way. So how do we learn from our mistakes when we're very aware that we're making them, and maybe people have criticized us in the past for the mistakes we made? And that led us to making more mistakes, you know.
Yeah, often out of panic, or frustration, or resentment, or there's numerous emotional factors. Yeah, absolutely.
So the next one, commitment to learning, seeking always to expand awareness, and having a commitment to growth as a way of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, and these systems we've been talking about, schooling system in particular, is opposed to that. Even though maybe the practitioners would contend otherwise, but if you start looking at it from a self-esteem vantage point, rather than those hidden lessons, right?
Yeah.
That Gatto points out, that you see that there's a lot of growth that is being stunted.
It's interesting, too. Obviously, it's a very vague word, right? So maybe the definition, their definition of growth is, you know, as you get older, you'll get better at math and gym. And that, I mean, I'm not, you know, that's silly, but that could be one definition.
And you'll know the capital of every state in the union.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sure, you didn't know that when you were six, but look at you now at 11, you know, and you can even color the map. But I think that we would probably incorporate into a definition of growth things like self-sufficiency, self-actualization. And it's not that those things don't happen in many ways, almost through natural processes between the ages of, you know, being very young to becoming a young adult. But if they are happening, from my research anyway, Wes, it really seems like it's in spite of school, which is
absolutely
really, you know, kind of this anvil that people have to drag around. And really it, beyond just not being mentally healthy, like physically unhealthy, to take a child and constrain or basically restrain them to a seat, you know, when they need to move. I forget who said, maybe it was Maria Montessori who said that a moving child is a wiggly child, you know, and sit still, stop wiggling, stop fidgeting. Yeah.
Reminds me of that article Rand wrote called The Comprachicos. Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Put them in these molds, tighten it down, and then you're going to have a fine product when they're done.
Right. Right. I remember a time when I looked at this and I said, God, what a tragic consequence of this kind of state control. And I didn't realize how many people had benefited from exactly what Rand described, you know, and other people have described. John Gatto, John Holt, Alfie Cohn has touched on this. This was no accident. You know, a lot of thought went into how people can be controlled through a quote unquote educational environment. And, you know, that was a very infuriating thing to learn, that when you see what happens to human beings, that it was intentional for the very reasons, some of the things we've already talked about, because it was for the good of society. It was for the good of the collective.
Yeah, and you can't trust those children to learn on their own.
Right. Yeah.
That lack of trust. And that those people, those grown adults that architected that system, they weren't unschooled.
Yeah.
You know, had they been unschooled, they wouldn't have tried to control people.
Right. Absolutely. I agree. You know? Good point.
They were controlled immensely in their childhoods, and they learned that as a template to design a system for ultimate control.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was their strategy that they chose that leads to all kinds of misery.
Yeah.
And harm to people, harm to minds, and harm to, I mean, just a society of debilitated self-esteem, essentially.
Yeah.
So how do we pick up the pieces and make sense of it, you know? Starts first with living consciously. The first step of realizing, you know, he says here, a concern to understand the world around me, a concern to know not only external reality, but also internal reality, the reality of my needs, feelings, aspirations, and motives, so that I am not a stranger or a mystery to myself.
And those four things, often very silent through this experience that we're talking about, you know, of schooling. Needs, that's, you know, that's selfish. You're creating problems. You're not being a team player. You're not contributing to the learning environment. Feelings would all be dismissed, I think, the same way. Aspirations are often oversimplified. They're usually obviously strongly tied into pleasing other people, meeting pretty arbitrary external evaluations of performance and aptitude. And that affects motives, right? Because nothing is intrinsic eventually. And I know, obviously, I'm painting with a broad brush here because there are different experiences to be had in different places by different people in different situations in school. But yeah, I mean, this is something that we keep coming back to, that actually motives that we arrive at ourselves are what? How would that happen?
Yeah.
You know, at that age. It's not part of the training we get.
Yeah. So the last one, a concern to be aware of the values that move and guide me, as well as their roots, so that I am not ruled by values I have irrationally adopted or uncritically accepted from others.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah, in your,
that's
in
a big
your previous
one.
Analysis of that, how so much of ourselves is suppressed, it's kind of like this mantra, conform, comply, obey. Like, that's the message that's being sent, regardless of what they're trying to do, you know? Rather than saying, hey, I have an idea of what might be enriching for you in terms of learning. You're free not to indulge in it, you know? Eat at this banquet that I presented. If you don't like any of the food here, you can go to the next table. No big deal, right? I just want you to be enriched. But that's not how the system approaches the intrinsic motivation of children, does it?
No, no. It's an annoyance, you know? And it's silenced. And I think that there's the ways that it shows up actually leads to young people feeling guilty.
Guilty about their own self-expression, huh? Guilty about asserting their own needs. Yeah, doing things their own way. Yeah.
You know, the last show I did was about zero tolerance, which is celebrating its one generation anniversary in the schools.
Yeah.
And, you know, I told a story at the beginning of the show about how I was a senior in high school in 1994 and 1995. And the disciplinarians were thoughtless then. You know, something bad happens, something has to be punished. Somebody has to be punished.
Good old punishment model, yeah.
I wound up being ensnared by the drug-free school zones policy one time. But I just remember how thought had been removed from the equation. And everything was, from the administrator's and teacher's point of view, everything was this binary choice, this black and white choice between obedient and disobedient. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like, granted, there's 1,500 other kids there that I guess they're trying to manage and pay attention to, and a bunch of teachers and, you know, facilities. But really wasn't meeting my needs when every time that I'm evaluated, it's this either or, obedient, disobedient.
According to our rules, we make the rules and you're going to abide by them or not. And we're going to indicate whether or not you do. But this other category of independent people, we don't want to acknowledge that.
Right.
Because that means that we're irrelevant, does it not? It means that maybe what we're doing is not so helpful. And it's hard to bring awareness to that and really reassess and really honor ourselves in a way that can grow and change and adapt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. one of the suggestions that Brandon makes in this portion of the book, and we touched on this briefly already, was using these sentence stems, these sentence completion exercises. And I felt like this was a really helpful exercise when it takes the conscious, let me take out the word conscious and just say the judgmental mind out of the equation.
Yeah.
And, you know, allows us more to activate, to look at a prompt and activate the subconscious and write things without really being afraid of what people would think or trying to rationalize why that makes sense. But can you talk a little bit about sentence completion? Because I know you use them in your counseling work, and you obviously really recommend this book right here, The Art of Self-Discovery.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I like it so much, I violated all the copyrights and ripped it apart, scanned it, made a downloadable PDF and doc file of it so people can use it. I mean, the publisher, was it Bantam, I think? It's out of print, essentially. So you'll find it on Amazon, used copies.
Yeah.
But it was published, I think, back in the 90s. And it's a really nice complement to the Six Pillars book, which has its own sentence stems in it as well. But The Art of Self-Discovery is very comprehensive and very helpful in terms of understanding, getting a map of our internal world, our subconscious realm. Yeah, you can download it for free from there. Or if you want to pick up the Six Pillars, in each back of each one of these chapters, there are these sentence stems. And it's just basically to trigger, like you say, the super rapid appraisals or thoughts or judgments that we have below conscious awareness without inhibiting them, you know, without thinking that there's some right or wrong answer, but just rather kind of letting your own mind speak itself, like the mind's within our mind in a sense, you know. Stephen Molyneux talks about a Miko system, and so does internal family systems therapy, all these different parts in ourselves. Well, there are actually aspects of our experiences from childhood and teenage years and so forth that never really had a voice. And this is what it does. It gives them a voice. It gives your emotions a voice in a way that you may not get in a discussion with anybody else in your life. So you can do this as your own personal journal, if you will. No one has to see the endings, but you. So stems like in this chapter, living consciously to me means, and just provide, you know, 6 to 10 endings to that as quickly as possible, and you'll get the gist of it. I like these ones about 5%. So if I bring 5% more awareness to my activities today.
That's interesting.
If I pay more attention to how I deal with people today, if I bring 5% more awareness to my most important relationships. So it's beckoning us to bring more awareness to these realms that may have some closed doors, may just have some status quo functioning. Right.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I think I like the way you phrased it. I get stuck on the 5%.
I usually bump it up to 10%.
Yeah. And actually thinking, I think you get that my logical part of my mind gets caught there. And it's like, well, okay, well, what really is 10% of my awareness?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
What is, or five, but what is 1/20th of my, you know, awareness of my priorities.
Yeah. Can it be quantified? It really can't be quantified. He's just kind of speaking in metaphor there, right?
Sure.
If I can bring
more awareness. But it's a great question.
Awareness. Yeah. Yeah.
To say more awareness to these things, what happens?
That might be more overwhelming even. Like if he doesn't quantify it as 5%, but just says if I bring more awareness, you might get a sense of overwhelm. You know, because you're thinking, oh, shit, I got to bring 100% awareness now. Oh, no. But if I can just bring 5%, maybe that's manageable. Maybe that I can do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Doable sort of requests of self.
Yeah.
And then, you know, bring 5% more awareness, fill in any particular problem you're concerned about. For example, your relationship with someone or a barrier you've hit at work or your feelings of anxiety or depression.
Yeah.
When I reflect on how I would feel if I lived more consciously, that's an interesting one. How would you feel if you lived more consciously? Could be some troubling feelings, but could be some joyful feelings, some uplifting feelings.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that came to mind for me is like a greater sense of balance and control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the more, I mean, you'd like to think, just like in our productive lives or our professional lives, the more we could take in, you know, and integrate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I wish I have this just this fantasy that everything that anybody sends me,
uh-huh.
I could just immediately turn it around and make it useful to 1,000 people.
Yeah. Right?
Brett, read this. Watch this video. And I watch it and I say, yeah, all right, great. Oh, here's something that I could do. But I'm already doing this. So table that, and then like it just kind of fades off into the back of my to-dos or into the maybe someday category of stuff. So yeah, I mean that speaks to this idea of being able to manage the inputs of consciousness better and turn them around into something meaningful. It's a question that has amazing potential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
a stem that comes to mind, given what we've talked about the systems we live in. If I can live consciously, if I can live more consciously without fearing pain and punishment,
yeah,
that can expand our consciousness, right? To see more possibilities, because we live in a culture that people have a lot of fear of punishment. You know, rightly so, obviously. Yeah. When you see all the police brutality videos.
Of course, also a question that could have some dangerous answers for some, you know?
Yeah. To look at these as meditative experiences that don't necessarily require action, although it's mm-hmm. important to integrate some of the essentials so that action is taken. So like his stem, if any of what I've wrote this week is true, it might be helpful if I... And that's kind of that sort of call to action process.
So if people are just hearing about this for the first time, do you have any recommendations on how to start interfacing? I mean, is this the book? Is this the way to do it?
You know, The Art of Self-Discovery, the first half of that actually explains in detail the whole process. And he gives lots of examples of clients that, you know, provide their endings. That's usually how he does it. And in The Art of Self-Discovery, or the Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, he has a little preface here talking about how to do it. So, you're not going to be in the dark if you just start with the six pillars.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it's just about doing it in a way that is not going to provoke that sort of analytical mind, you know, to really just see it as a meditative experience and that there are no right or wrong answers. So just dive in, do it, and see what happens. See what comes out.
As we draw to a close today, I was trying to formulate a list of obstacles. Mm-hmm. And I think through the conversation we've had so far, we've already covered a lot of them. But another one that occurred to me is the sort of technological environment that we live in today. Daniel Siegel, actually, I think in that Taking Time In talk, spoke about this as well. And the internet is this, or the technological world generally is this unfinished thing, right? It's new every time you go back.
Yeah.
To use some GTD language, it's an open loop that you can never close. You can never conclude. You can never experience completion. And I think I've said things on the show before, like maybe our minds are not evolved to handle this high level of stimulation. But I think that people today often confuse being more aware or potentially more aware or having more access to information from the outside world is raising this sort of vague term consciousness. But I think one of the things that we need to be careful of, and this is what Siegel points out, is that all of that time and energy that can be going in is getting sucked out.
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. I told a story of one time how it was me and you and someone else, and we were talking, and I said one time I was sitting somewhere where I had to wait, and my phone died, and I got sad. You know, because I'm like, well, and it's usually not something that I would think I would have a problem with. Like, I would never say, oh, I could never be alone in my own head for a minute. That would be too scary. You know, I feel like I'm doing that every night before I go to bed. But there was just something that it was kind of like a sign of the times that I'm sitting at a table waiting on somebody and my access to whatever, Words with Friends or Facebook, this was maybe about a year ago, just ends. And then it's just me in a seat. That by itself, the embrace of new technology and the access to greater amounts of information is not synonymous with an increase in consciousness as it's defined in the six pillars.
Yeah, yeah. So the takeaway is allocate your time, you know, accordingly. Brandon has a phrase he likes, a Spanish proverb, take what you want, said God, and pay for it. Right. So there's a price to pay for spending time doing things that aren't related to self-awareness, self-improvement. So to set aside time for that, I think is really important. But also to improve our own understanding of things, because it's like on that phone could have been an episode of some podcast that's really enriching too.
Yeah.
You know, people are finding a lot of enrichment in that as well with these technological devices. So to, I mean, we're faced with that multiplicity of choices thing once again, aren't we? And and the choices are getting more and more and more and faster and faster and faster. And I think it's just important to get back to those essentials to help ourselves be grounded in what really matters in our lives and to look at all these different possibilities for enrichment as, you know, something that can be managed, something that can be accepted as it is. And we're going to devise technologies to sort through that. I mean, there's already those, you know, curators of knowledge out there. In a sense, the podcasting community can be seen as curators of knowledge, you know, gathering the news items that are most prevalent or important to talk about, and then relating that those things to other people. So we don't have to sift through every possible news feed, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's helpful. But, you know, you were telling your story. It reminded me of another Louis C.K. story. I think he was talking with Conan O'Brien. Remember that? Where he's like, we can't, like, spend time processing our emotions. Like, we get this feeling of sadness or something, and we immediately start, you know, we're driving our car, and we have to text, like, five different people just to get a response from someone, right?
Yeah,
instead of just working through that, like, pulling over and crying it out, working through the sadness, and then you feel this, like, joy. Like, the way he talks about it is really amusing, and it speaks to the truth of the matter that we do live with a lot of angst in our society and depression and some sadness. So it's important to really check in with ourselves, to have that mindset, rather than going to these devices to try to connect and find solace. We can find that within ourselves, essentially.
Yeah. It's on a somewhat related note, it actually reminds me of another great comedian named Pete Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about Google, and he says, do you remember what it was like to be impregnated with wonder? Do you remember what it was like? Because he's, you know, he's like around our age, like mid late 30s. And he says, you remember like waking up, being like, where is Tom Petty born? I wonder where Tom Petty was born. But then you had to wonder about it for more than like 5 minutes, and you could be really like satisfied with yourself. You it was a real achievement when you got home from the library that day and you found out. Now, obviously, that's less than optimal for a lot of things, but it's an interesting observation that how it connects to the Louis C.K. thing is there was a time through which you and I lived where we had no other option. It's hard to even think about.
When you didn't even have a phone as you're driving your vehicle. No access to anybody else.
Yeah. We had no other option other than to be inside our heads.
Yeah. Or to turn on the FM or AM radio, right? Or listen to a cassette.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to think about.
Back in my day, we didn't even have radios. We had to sing our own tunes.
Right.
So yeah, each age presents new challenges for sure. Yeah. But taking time in, I think, is really key. And that's, you know, part of that living consciously process.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think that wraps up the first pillar, Wes.
Cool. Yeah. It's a wrap. Thanks for having me on, Brett. And I look forward to continuing the series. We like series.
Yeah, I do. Series are great. Get a lot done in a series. So can you, just for people, if anybody is new to the show and they haven't searched the archives of probably 30 shows that you're on, can you tell them where they can find more of your work?
You bet. CompleteLiberty.com is my main site, and I have that podcast. Approaching the 200th episode, I'm doing a series now on restorative justice, which I think is a much-needed focus, you know, in terms of living consciously, on what could be the possibilities besides the punishment model to have a society of justice and fairness and, you know, people integrated into a community that has empathy. So that's been the latest shows I've been doing. I have a series of nonviolent communication and morality and a bunch of other things on my site, happinesscounseling.com. I've got them listed there on the resources page. So that's something to check out. And that's also the page you can find the Art of Self-Discovery to download. So happinesscounseling.com, and then just click on resources, and you'll find it.
Excellent. I was actually, I was thinking about how many times you've been on this show. I've actually been on that show of yours a few times.
You have, indeed, a whole bunch of times. And I haven't parsed out all those different times. I don't have a list of those. I need to do that. I think I do have the one of the education series we did, 46 through 51, I think it was, episodes.
Why I described School Sucks podcast, I think last year at Liberty Forum, I said it's a spinoff of Complete Liberty, because that was the the first time that I had a conversation for other people to hear about those topics, and that was a great opportunity. I said we'll sit down and we'll do an hour, and I'll tell you what I think, and we talk for like 7 or 8.
Yep, exactly.
The rest is history.
Par for the course.
Yeah,
also did a series on intellectual property, so-called, with Daniel Lachemacher. That was pretty fun. So
yes.
You find that somewhere buried in the archives. Like I think it's like a 10-part series, so it goes into episode 80 or something. But yeah, I've got to parse all those out. So I have pretty descriptive show notes and titles, too, so you can find them that way.
Absolutely, but, yeah.
That was a fun series we did, and I'm glad that the spinoff has turned into this amazing show that so many people, I mean, I've encountered people that have encountered my stuff through your show. So that's cross-pollination going on.
Excellent. I'm always happy to hear that. All right. We can leave it there and we'll pick it up next week.
Excellent.
Once there was a boy and girl. Boy said, I love you so. Girl said, I never. Sometimes